Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Foreign Correspondents Club Board. First, just a couple of housekeeping announcements. Please, everyone, turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them on mute. If you do it now, you shouldn't be embarrassed, but if it comes up later, if it interferes with the recording, you'll be much more embarrassed then. With that, let me also mention our next speaker tomorrow. We still have some seats left. It'll be one of our most important foreign policy speeches this year. Yang Jimian is the president emeritus of one of the leading foreign policy institutes in China. He is being brought to us by the foreign ministry, and he will be speaking on what will be potential roles or responses by China to possible challenges ahead, which has often been difficult for us to get mainland speakers to address. He's also the brother of the former foreign minister. He's somebody who's deeply knowledgeable about Chinese diplomacy. We still have some seats left for that tomorrow, and we hope to see you there. With that, let me introduce our speaker today. There's been a growing group of historians looking at revisionist interpretations, whether it's of Russia, all the evidence now that we are finding, or that historians are finding, that Russia was one of the fastest developing countries in Europe prior to 1917, or that Cuba was thriving prior to 1959. One of the most important historians in recent years of China has been Yong Chang, with her biography of Mao, a scathing indictment of Mao's rule. Now she's written a new biography suggesting the person whom she thinks may have played a bigger role in laying the foundations for China's extraordinary success in recent years, and that's the Empress Dowager Cixi. We've had a number of books this year, a number of authors this year, and I can tell you this is the most interesting book I've read since Restless Empire by Arne Westad early this year, Chinese History Since 1750. If you haven't read it, I absolutely recommend it. With that, Ms. Chang.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here to talk about Empress Dowager Cixi, the concubine who launched the modern China. Now, you can see this is Cixi. And this is the Beijing of her time. She was born in 1835. And at the age of 16, she went through one of those periodic imperial selections for royal consort. And she caught the emperor's eye, and she was selected as one of his concubines, a low rank concubine. And this is her as a imperial concubine playing chess with a eunuch who was standing. And this is her husband, Emperor Xianfeng. Now, in 1860, the Emperor Xianfeng fled Beijing with the court. And the reason was that the British, with some French troops, invaded Beijing. And the British wanted China to open up more ports for trade. But Emperor Xianfeng, like his father and grandfather, stubbornly resisted this demand. So the British came, and led by Lord Elgin, the son of the Lord Elgin, the Elgin marble repute or disrepute. But in any case, and Lord Elgin burned down the old summer palace. And Emperor Xianfeng was in the northern wilderness of China. He was so heartbroken at this palace being burned down, and he refused to return to Beijing. So in 1861, he died in self-imposed exile, and he appointed eight princes to supervise his only son, with Cixi. This is not the son. Yeah, this is the this is one of the ancestors of the Pekingese dog. Because when the British got into the old summer palace, the Yuan Ming Yuan, and they found an elderly imperial concubine had died of fright. She didn't flee with the court. And around her body were these five Pekingese dogs. So the British brought the five dogs back, and this one was presented to Queen Victoria, and it was named Luti. And Queen Victoria had Luti painted and specifically asked for Luti to be placed next to something to see, to show how small she was. Can we get rid of that? Oh, and, okay. Oh, God, okay. Right. And this is Cixi's son, Emperor Tongzhi, the boy in blue. And he was actually a year younger than his sister. But somehow, in all court paintings, he was always twice the size as his elder sister. Now, at the Emperor Xianfeng's death, Cixi, aged 25, launched a coup and ousted these eight powerful princes. And the her coup was immensely popular because she asked a very intelligent and fresh question, which is, why must we resist the West's attempt to open our doors? Why can't we use open door to benefit China? And that thought, of course, revolutionized China. It was from 1861 that China began to open its door. But she, all the time, because she was a woman, she was not supposed to rule, so she had to sit behind this silk screen, not just behind the throne, but behind the silk screen. And her young son was put occasionally on the throne, and the officials would prostrate themselves in front of them. Now, she never, as the supreme leader of China, on and off, mainly on, from 1861 to 1908, she never set foot on the front part of the Forbidden City. I mean, you know, you've all been to the Forbidden City, and you know the gigantic, grand front part. And that part was forbidden to women. And so she never set foot on it. And she was confined to the harem, which she hated, and she said it was all gates and the walls. Now, she was able to launch her reform with the help of some men, of course, because she was not allowed to set foot outside the palaces. And the man in the middle is Li Hongzhang. I think probably he's not unfamiliar to most of you. Li Hongzhang. And this is Li Hongzhang visiting Britain with him, Prime Minister Lord Salisbury and Lord Curzon. And when the first thing Cixi did was to employ the Chinese Gordon, Charles the Chinese Gordon, who helped her defeat the Taiping rebels, and that created peace and a degree of prosperity in China for the Cixi era. And here is Gordon in his Chinese robe. And there is another Brit, Robert Hart, an Ulster man. Robert Hart here is with his band, his Western music band, but with Chinese musicians. Cixi appointed Robert Hart to be in charge of Chinese customs, and Hart did a remarkable job, a very little acknowledged job for Chinese economy. At one time, he contributed as much as one third of China's national revenue. He also gave Cixi advice. It was one of the channels through which Cixi learned about the West. Of course, they very rarely met, but they communicated through copious sort of correspondence, letters, and also through her diplomats and Li Hongzhang. Now, the man standing in the middle is an American, Anson Burlingame, who was President Lincoln's first minister to China as soon as Cixi opened the door. Now, when his term ended, Cixi then employed him as her and China's first ambassador to the West. He traveled around the world with his two Chinese deputies and two secretaries, one English and one French, to tell the West that China had changed. China embraces the West. And he died on his journey working for the interest of China. He spent nearly 2 years on the road. And then Cixi then introduced the, you know, electricity, telegraphs, telegrams, and a modern sort of a way of conducting diplomacy, a modernized sort of navy and the army. And she also sent young children to America to be trained, you know, in the Western way. Most of these people who were sent abroad in the 1870s, then later came back and became the sort of backbones of Chinese modernization. Now Cixi has one problem, which is that as a woman, she couldn't rule. So she must retire and go back to the harems once her son grew up, came of age. Her son, Emperor Tongzhi, came of age, so she retired. And Emperor Tongzhi was 16. He was not interested in modernization. He was interested in what all the 16-year-olds are interested, you know, play, sex, frequenting Brussels. Not all 16-year-olds frequenting Brussels, but he loved frequenting Brussels and visiting male and female prostitutes and so on. But he died before he was 19. And so she then put her nephew, who she adopted, Emperor Guangxu, on the throne. And Emperor Guangxu was then 3 years old. And so Emperor Guangxu grew up while Cixi continued to modernize China. Now, but Cixi was not a good mother, and she was alienated from her adopted son, Emperor Guangxu, who became increasingly close to his classics teacher, Wong Tonghe. Now, and the two, Wong Tonghe was archi-conservative. He was against the railways, he was against the telegrams, he hated foreigners and called them wolves and tigers. So Emperor Guangxu then shelved Cixi's modernizing projects. Now Japan then seized this opportunity, the retirement of the Empress Dowager, and launched a war against China in 1894. And in Japan, there were, you know, first-rate statesmen. And in China, there was this 20-something-year-old Emperor Guangxu who was schooled exclusively in the Confucian classics. From the age of 4, he spent his time imbibing Confucian classics. He never even wanted to go out of the Forbidden City, you know, unlike Cixi, who was dying to travel, but she couldn't. And he could, but he didn't want to. So he spent all his time in the Forbidden City with his classics teacher, who was his father figure. And he made, when the war started, he made Wong Tonghe his number one war advisor. And the result, of course, not surprisingly, a devastating defeat by Japan. And that was the beginning of the end of the ruin of China, according to the American minister then. And then after Japan's success and China's defeat, I'm afraid the Western powers then started to behave not so well. And before that, they had sort of this respect for China. But now they saw China was a giant paper tiger. And as Robert Hart said, the bubble of China had burst. So they all came and grabbed a bit of China. Germany grabbed the area around the Qingdao. You know, you must all have had the Qingdao beer. And that's because the Germans first made it. And then the Russians grabbed a bit, the British grabbed a bit. I mean, you probably know Kowloon was then incorporated into Hong Kong. And the Japanese grabbed a lot Taiwan and established spheres of influence in Fujian. Now, this foreign occupation, I mean, inevitably created conflict with the locals. I mean, these are the xenophobic boxers. Now, the boxers, people think of the boxers as though they were all over China. Far from it. They were only in Shandong, around the areas near Qingdao. And one reason was that I'm afraid the Germans were very heavy-handed in trying to suppress any anti-foreign sentiment. They burned down villages, killed some villagers, and whilst the Boxers also murdered missionaries and particularly Chinese Christians. So there is a burst of the Boxer mayhem. Now, the Empress Dowager was actually all for clamping down on the Boxers. That was her policy. For all these incidents, you know, involving foreigners, her motto was 持平办理, to treat it fairly. But then that wasn't enough for the powers. And they threatened invasion. They gave Cixi an ultimatum. If she wasn't wiping out the Boxers in 3 months, they were going to invade China. Foreign gunboats were outside Dagu Fort, outside Beijing. And Cixi, like a drowning person, you know, grasping a straw, so she then made a misguided decision of trying to use the Boxers to fight the invaders. Of course, the Boxers did nothing of the sort. They only looted, they killed, they even nearly looted their Forbidden City. And Cixi was driven out of Beijing. And this is the Allied forces, Allied of eight European powers and America and Japan entering the Forbidden City. So she left in a hurry because she had decided to die in the Forbidden City because she knew she made a terrible mistake, which she repented later on. I mean, but at the last minute, she was persuaded to flee. And then this is, you probably heard of this, imperial concubine pearl. If you have been to the Forbidden City, inevitably you would have been shown this well into which pearl was drowned by Cixi. And from Cixi's point of view, she was in a hurry. She didn't want to take her with her. And the reason was she was Emperor Guangxu's favorite concubine. And both she and Emperor Guangxu had been involved in a plot to kill her. And Emperor Guangxu had been put under house arrest by Cixi. So Cixi then ordered Pearl to commit suicide. And Pearl refused. And Cixi then ordered a eunuch to throw her down the well. But during the exile, Cixi reflected on her own crimes, as she said herself, and she issued an edict, 自责之诏, to an imperial edict to reproach herself, and she repented many times to foreigners, to her entourage, and so on. So she made peace with the West, and this is her returning to Beijing in 1902, and she was waving outside the sedan chair, waving to a foreign photographer who was snatching a photograph of her from the city wall. And you know, Chinese monarchs were not allowed to be seen in the old days. But Cixi had learned from the people she had been sending abroad to learn Western ways, which she had been doing from 1861. She had learned from these envoys that Western monarchs waved at their people. So this is how she learned to wave, and this was her first wave. And Western powers also, you know, as I said, they made peace with her, and they decorated this imperial locomotive for her to return to Beijing. And from that moment on, in 1902, Cixi then stepped from behind the screen to the front of the stage and launched what I think is rightfully called the real revolution of 20th century China. And she, the first thing she did was to ban foot binding. You know, the foot binding, the crippling of girls' feet that had tortured Chinese women for over 1,000 years. And so she banned it. And she abolished the old educational system and installed a new Western-style educational system, which is what China is having today. And she introduced the Western legal systems and abolished the notorious death by a thousand cuts and so on. And she introduced the free press. She, in the last few years of her life, she was trying to introduce a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament. In other words, she was trying to give the vote to the Chinese, but unfortunately, she died. Now, this was a picture she was taken in 1903. And it was colored tastefully and so on, and airbrushed. And this picture, when she saw this picture, she was so thrilled. She had it blown up to all sizes, and hung everywhere in the palace. But she really looked like that. But I mean, and this was her nearly year 70. But she, you know, she acted like a coquettish young girl, and the reason is the negatives of her photographs are all in the Smithsonian Museum in America. And in the Forbidden City, they only had airbrushed the prints. Now, okay, now Cixi's life actually was very tragic because she lived among eunuchs. And the emperor was the only other man. And so in her younger days, she fell in love with a eunuch, and with two tragic consequences, because the eunuch was beheaded and his corpse was exposed for days to show the public that he had no male organ. And so she suffered a nervous breakdown. Okay, that's her funeral. Now, the one last thing I wanted to say was the day before she died, Cixi murdered her adopted son, Emperor Guangxu, who was also very ill. And from her point of view, it was because she knew if she had died and he was alive, China would fall into the hands of Japan, because the Japanese were trying very hard to make her adopted son the puppet, very much like they made the last emperor, Puyi, the puppet 20 years later. But Puyi was, of course, only in charge of Manchuria in northeast China, and Emperor Guangxu had the whole of China. And Cixi then, after the murder, she died the next day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Ms. Zhang will stay here after the Q&A to sign books, but first we're going to have about 20 minutes of questions. Why don't I start it off? There was a very favorable review of your book by Orville Schell in the New York Times a couple of days ago, but it did raise the question it said at times bordering on hagiography, that it was so positive in its interpretations of the Empress Dowager's motives. For each of your chapters tends to end with a positive interpretation, often praised, summarizing that chapter. And it's almost discordant, for example, when one of the chapters ends with her having a concubine pearl thrown down the well. It sort of contrasts with the other chapter endings. What do you say to those who ask whether it's, whether you are leaning in the other direction to counter previous interpretations of Cixi as a despot, And then second of all, can we really know her motives or interpret them, given that a lot of the documents were actually written by others for her?
Well, actually, I think in my book,
I documented every single one of Tse Shih's killings, some of which have not even been documented by the have not even been put out by the official propaganda, official nationalist, communist propaganda. And of course, I didn't document everyone in her other, you know, sort of brutal wars, like, you know, when she tried to reconquer Xinjiang. And that was a very brutal expedition, but I mentioned it in detail. So there isn't anything, I think no accuser can name a single, I think, I mean, you know, it's still early days, but I'd rather predict a single atrocity or whatever that Tse Shih did that I did not document in my book. Now, what I did was to provide the context and why Tse Shih did it. For example, the poisoning of Emperor Guangxu was only established in 2008 when Emperor Guangxu's corpse was put through forensic scientist examination, and they discovered there was a huge amount of arsenic. And I was there in Beijing, actually, I attended that that hearing. Now, the hearing in Beijing ended on the note, why did Tse Shih murder him? I mean, now the traditional one, which doesn't convince any of the scholars, is Tse Shih was just awful. I mean, you know, for the heck of it. But no, I mean, you know, but that's not in character. And I, from my study of the document, I realized how important Japan was, the role of Japan was in trying to, ever since the war, ever since Japan beat China, how Japan was trying to encroach on China. And particularly when they realized Emperor Guangxu was such a weak emperor, how they tried to make him the puppet and dominate the whole of China, and what steps they made, including to assassinate Tse Shih, many, many attempts as documented in my book. And the inevitable conclusion for me is that she killed him in order to prevent this scenario. Now, what was her vision for China then? I think at that point, she accepted republicanism, because her last political decree was to make sure, was to hand in the power to this weak woman, Emperor Guangxu's Long Yu, Empress Long Yu, to this weak woman, who the details I don't want to get into. Anyway, this was a political decree that made sure that Empress Long Yu would surrender the dynasty to the rising Republican uprisings. And that is exactly what happened 3 years later, when the anticipated Republican uprisings burst out in China, and Empress Long Yu announced the abdication of the Manchu dynasty, not just the emperor, but to surrender the dynasty to the Chinese people. So some say, you know, oh, if you say Tse Shih is so strong and great and so on, why is her dynasty fall? Well, the thing is, it was never her ultimate goal to preserve her dynasty, and her goal was to preserve China. Well, I did develop sympathy for her, as you can see. I mean, you know, but that was from my research. I mean, also, by the way, it is a biographer's job to enter the head of your subject. I mean, that is my job. I felt I entered Mao's head, and I felt I entered Tse Shih's head.
Thank you very much. Florence.
Hello, I'm Florence de Changier, report for Le Monde. My first question was actually, how much do you like her now that you know her so well? Would she be your friend? Or and the second question, because you mentioned to us that you're currently working on a translation in Chinese, do you think the book would be subversive to some extent in China? And if so, why so?
Well, the first question, actually, I probably wouldn't like Cixi, wouldn't sort of, I don't think I would, we would become sort of friends or something. You know, that's out of question, yeah. But the thing is this, she was actually, you know, she, for example, I mean, she wanted her adopted son, Emperor Guangxu, to call her Qin Baba, or which means Papa Dearest, or Huang Baba, my royal father. She aspired for a man's role. I mean, she was not a good mother to her adopted son. I mean, she also didn't like children. I mean, she sort of, at one sort of aristocratic gathering, a child started crying and wouldn't stop. And so she was so annoyed, she ordered the mother to bring the child out of court. And she gave the mother a lecture saying, you know, this is a punishment not just for her, but also for you, you should, you know, which has actually contributed to the alienation of Emperor Guangxu from her, and Emperor Guangxu's closeness to this archi-conservative royal tutor, and China's disasters. She was also, she was also somebody who's very tough. You know, she was curious in many things. I mean, she tried everything: tricycle, tried to skate. She even wanted to try a hot air balloon. She was persuaded out of it. But the only thing that was in her was at her disposal, but she didn't try, was the car, because she insisted. She knew that the court was so fragile, and it was held up by rigid protocol. So she insisted on everybody kneeling in front of her, or standing, when getting permission. And but in the car, the driver can't drive standing, let alone kneeling. So the driver would have to sit right in front of her. So she then sacrificed her curiosity and never rode in a car.
What about
second question? I don't know, the current Beijing is changing. I'm not sure. At the time when I was researching Wild Swans from 2008, Cixi was certainly not considered sensitive. I was given access to the archives, to the First National Archives in the Forbidden City, and the Qing scholars helped me, in such a wonderful way. And of course, they had all read, it's all because of a Mao biography. So they helped me tremendously. But then suddenly, these things changing, a lot of people in Beijing are calling a return to Mao's days and using Mao's method. And therefore, I think the Empress Dowager might be sensitive because she faced the same problem as the current regime, which is decades of economic development, open door, rising aspiration, an increasingly free press, and now where do we go from here? She rejected all the calls for her to clamp down on the press, to stop sending students abroad, but she refused to wind the clock back. She pushed forward for a constitutional reform to establish an elected parliament. Whereas in Beijing, they're not doing the same. They seem to be trying to, some at least, seem to be trying to wind the clock back. So she may become sensitive. And the other thing is, I don't think Beijing wants to raise my profile.
Why don't we take a couple questions from the audience here? While you think about your questions, there's an interesting discussion of the Empress Dowager, of your questions. Well, there's an interesting discussion of Tibet and how she tried to balance holding on to Tibet against the threat of the British incursion in 1904. Arne Westad makes a very interesting, maybe even speculation or assertion in Restless Empire when he said that if Tibet had been willing to settle for a small country, perhaps it could have achieved independence as Mongolia did in between 1911 and 1949. I mean, the Mongolians settled for Outer Mongolia becoming an independent country and Inner Mongolia remaining part of China. Tibet was more reluctant to be divided into a smaller Tibet that would to be recognized as a small Tibet, not including the larger areas. Do you think from your research on the Empress Dowager that that the seeds were planted during the Qing Dynasty, or what did her actions in the Qing Dynasty help China hold on to all of Tibet as it did so?
Well, I think some of this is slightly out of the Empress Dowager's time, yeah, like outer Mongolia. At the time, Mongolia was firmly, at her time, firmly part of China. Now, outer Mongolia was ultimately going was ultimately able to get its independence because of Soviet Russia. Russia occupied parts of outer Mongolia and forced outer Mongolia out of China. I mean, there is a long history. Actually, in our Mao biography, there is some of the descriptions about the detachment of Outer Mongolia. Whereas Tibet, I mean, there wasn't. The Russians were rivaling with the British. I mean, they never got anywhere. And at that time, the Empress Dowager offered what was to the 13th Dalai Lama the most attractive option, which is to continue as before, just for Tibet to pay nominal sort of respect and everything to Beijing, and for Beijing to leave to leave Tibet completely alone, which is why you know, the British invaded, the young husbands invaded Tibet, and the 13th Dalai Lama fled, and so she there were mountains of documents. So she repeatedly asked the 13th Dalai Lama to return to Tibet and run it as before after the British withdrew. But the 13th Dalai Lama insisted on going to Beijing to see her, to name the deal, because she was the only person. She held back Chinese troops from the Tibetan border. I mean, she had appointed a kind of, the details I won't go into. Basically, her policy was to leave Tibet alone. And Tibet felt at that time, we're talking about at that time, at the beginning of the 20th century, that her offer was the best offer. I mean, they wouldn't have got that sort of independence from either the British or the Russians. I mean, but of course, after she died, things changed. China, then her successors, sent in troops, and the 13th Dalai Lama fled.
Okay. Who else? Back here, please. Sherry.
Hi, I'm Sherry Prasso from Bloomberg. First, I want to thank you not just for writing this book, but for your entire body of work, which I think has done more to bring, you know, women's issues to light and what they've faced in China historically than just about any other writer. So first of all, I'm very grateful. And second of all, I want to ask you, I think maybe I'm not the only person in this room who read Sterling Seagrave's account of the Empress Dowager's life. And I wonder if you found his interpretation, it was also very favorable, deficient in some ways, or what additional things did you find by also accessing Chinese sources that we can now get from reading this current work?
Yes. I mean, I did read Sterling Seagrave's book. I mean, I totally disagree with his interpretation. By the way, he didn't have the access to the Chinese documents I just mentioned. And because, because of this lack of the original documents, which actually shows what she was like, you could only speculate. I mean, I think he made some very intelligent speculations. But one I'm completely disagree is that I think if I remember correctly, this is a few years ago now when I read it, that she was really this weak woman, manipulated into doing all the wrong things by people around her. And that I totally disagree. It's not what the document says. I mean, it shows very clearly that she was the boss until her retirement, twice, you know, when her son grew up. I mean, all the decisions were made by her. The good decisions, the modernization decisions were made by her. I mean, you can see very clearly the Hong Zhang and the Prince Kong and all these men making suggestions, but she was always the person who made decisions. She made policy. And she also made wrong policies, like the decision to use the boxes. Either him or some other people trying to excuse her to say that actually she had no clue it was these other conservative Manchu grandees who were supporting the boxes. And that's also not true. She made the decisions, and whatever these Manchu conservative grandees can only suggest, make suggestions. So I now forgot what your first question was now, ultimately. Was it the feminist one? Sorry.
Congratulations on your body of work.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
But we have time for one more question. Jit, would you like to?
Thank you very much for joining us today. And you are free to speak your mind on these issues here in Hong Kong. Do you think, can you envisage a day anytime soon where you could deliver a similar message in the mainland?
I can't. That's a short answer. Well, the thing is this, my books are banned. I mean, I'm tolerated so far to go to China to see my mother, because my mother is in her 80s. She's frail. Perhaps thanks to Wild Swans, that I'm sort of allowed to go back for a short period of time every year to see my mother. But of course, in exchange, I've made a commitment not to speak at public gatherings, not to talk to the press, and not even to see my friends. Just restrict my visit to my mother and very close old friends who had nothing to do with politics. And as I said at the beginning of writing this book, to be able to see some Qing scholars. I just hope that I can still go back to China and see my mother.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Thank you all for coming. You very kindly agreed to stay and sign books. Before we go, we always like to give our guests something to remember the club
very
by.
Nice. Okay.
Thank
Once
you very
I'm
much.
Back.
A pen for an author. Thank you all for coming, and we hope to see many of you again here tomorrow for Yang Qimian's speech. Thank you all.
Thank you.